Vimes was only half surprised when the doors to the rat's chamber opened, and there, sitting at the head of the table, was Lord Rust. The patrician wasn't there. He was half surprised. That is, at a certain shallow level, he thought, "That's odd. I thought you couldn't budge the man with a siege weapon." But at a dark level, where the daylight seldom penetrated, he thought, "Of course. At a time like this, men like Rust rise to the top. It's like stirring a swamp with a stick. Really big bubbles are suddenly on the surface, and there's a bad smell about everything." Nevertheless, he saluted and said, "Lord Vetinari on his holidays, then."
"Lord Vetinari stepped down this evening, Vimes," said Lord Rust. "Pro tem, of course, just for the duration of the emergency."
"Really?" said Vimes.
"Yes, and I have to say that he anticipated a certain cynicism on your part, Commander, and therefore asked me to give you this letter. You will see that it is sealed with his seal."
Vimes looked at the envelope. There was certainly the official seal in the wax, but he met Lord Rust's gaze, and at least that suspicion faded. Rust wouldn't try a trick like that. Men like Rust had a moral code of sorts, and some things weren't honourable. You could own a street of crowded houses where people lived like cockroaches and the cockroaches lived like kings, and that was perfectly okay, but Rust would probably die before he'd descend to forgery.
"I see, sir," said Vimes. "You wanted me?"
"Commander Vimes, I must ask you to take the Clatchians resident in the city into custody."
"On what charge, sir?"
"Commander, we are on the verge of war with Clatch. Surely you understand?"
"No, sir."
"We are talking about spying, Commander. Sabotage, even," said Lord Rust. "To be frank, the city is to be placed under martial law."
"Yes, sir. What kind of law's that, sir?" said Vimes, staring straight ahead.
"You know very well, Vimes."
"Is it the kind where you shout stop before you fire, sir, or the other kind?"
"Ah, I see."
Rust stood up and leaned forward.
"It pleased you to be smart with Lord Vetinari, and for some reason he indulged you," he said. "I, on the other hand, know your type."
"My type?"
"It seems to me that the streets are full of crimes, Commander. Unlicensed begging, public nuisances, but you seem to turn a blind eye. You seem to think you should have bigger ideas. But you are not required to have big ideas, Commander. You are a thief-taker, nothing more." "Are you eyeballing me, Vimes?"
"I was trying not to turn a blind eye, sir."
"You seem to feel, Vimes, that the law is some kind of big glowing light in the sky which is not subject to control. And you are wrong. The law is what we tell it to be. I'm not going to add, 'Do you understand?' because I know you understand, and I am not going to try and reason with you. I know a rank bad hat when I see one."
"Bad hat," said Vimes weakly.
"Commander Vimes," he said, "I had hoped to avoid this. But the last few days point to a succession of astonishing judgmental errors on your part. The Prince Kufura was shot, and you seemed helpless to prevent this or find the criminal responsible. Mobs appear to run around the city unimpeded. I gather that one of your sergeants proposed to shoot innocent people in the head. And we have just heard that you took it upon yourself to arrest an innocent businessman and lock him in the cells for no reason at all."
Vimes heard Colon gasp, but it sounded a long way off. He could feel everything crumbling under him, but his mind seemed to be flying now, flapping through a pink sky where nothing mattered very much.
"Oh, I don't know about that, sir," he said. "He was guilty of repeatedly being Clatchian, wasn't he? Don't you want me to do that to all of them?"
"And if this was not enough," Rust went on, "we are told, and in other circumstances I would find this very hard to believe, even of a counter-jumper like you, that earlier tonight, you, being quite unprovoked, assaulted two Clatchian guards, trespassed on Clatchian soil, entered the women's quarters, abducted two Clatchians from their beds, ordered the destruction of Clatchian property, and, well, frankly, acted quite disgracefully."
What is the point of arguing? Vimes thought. Why play cards with a shaved deck? And yet... Two Clatchians, sir? It seems Prince Kufura has been kidnapped, Vimes. I find it hard to believe that even you would attempt that. But the Clatchians seem to be suggesting this. You were seen entering their property illegally, and you appear to have dragged a helpless lady from her bed. What have you got to say about that?
It was on fire at the time, sir.
Lieutenant Hornet stepped forward and whispered something. Lord Rust subsided a bit.
All right, very well. There were perhaps mitigating circumstances, but politically, it was a most ill-advised action, Vimes. I cannot pretend to know what has happened to the prince, but frankly, you seem to have taken a positive delight in making matters worse.
Can you climb, Mr. Vimes?
Vimes said nothing. The other man had been carrying something bulky over his shoulder.
You are removed from authority, Commander, and the watch will come under the direct command of this council. Is that understood?
Rust turned to Carrot.
Captain Carrot, many of us here have heard good reports about you, and by due authority, I hereby appoint you acting commander of the watch.
Vimes shut his eyes. Carrot saluted smartly.
No, sir.
Vimes opened his eyes wide.
Really?
Rust stared at Carrot for a few moments and then gave a little shrug.
Ah, well. Loyalty is a fine thing. Sergeant Colon?
Sir.
In the circumstances, and since you are the most experienced non-commissioned officer and have an exemplary... and have a military record... You will take command of the watch for the duration of the emergency.
No, sir.
That was an instruction, Sergeant.
Beads of sweat began to form on Colon's brow.
No, sir.
Sergeant!
You can put it where the sun does not shine, sir, said Colon desperately.
Once again, Vimes saw Rust's milky blue stare. Rust never looked surprised, and since he knew that a mere sergeant would never dare offer cheeky defiance, he erased Sergeant Colon from the immediate universe. The gaze turned briefly to Detritus. And he doesn't know how to speak to a troll, Vimes thought. And he was once again impressed in the same dark way by the manner in which Rust dealt with the problem. He dealt with it by making it not be there.
Who is the senior corporal in the watch, Sir Samuel?
That would be... Corporal Nobbs.
The committee went into a huddle. There was a rush of whispering in which the words, an absolute little tit, could be heard several times. Finally, Rust looked up again.
And the next in seniority?
Let me see, that would be Corporal Strong in the Arm, said Vimes.
He felt oddly light-headed.
Perhaps he is a man who can take orders.
He's a dwarf, you idiot.
Not a muscle moved on Rust's face. There was a clink as Vimes's badge was set neatly on the table.
I don't have to take this, said Vimes calmly.
Oh, so you'd rather be a civilian, would you?
A watchman is a civilian, you inbred streak of piss.
Rust's brain erased the sounds that his ears could not possibly have heard.
And the keys to the armory, Sir Samuel, he said.
They jangled as they landed on the table.
And do the rest of you have any empty gestures to make?
Said Lord Rust. Sergeant Colon took his grimy badge out of his pocket and was a little disappointed that it didn't make a defiant tinkle when he threw it on the table, but instead bounced and smashed the water jug.
I got my badge carved on my arm, Detritus rumbled. Someone can try and take it off if they likes.
Carrot laid his badge down very carefully. Rust raised his eyebrows.
You too, Captain.
Yes, sir.
I would have thought that you, at least.
He stopped and looked up in annoyance as the doors opened. A couple of the palace guards ran in with a group of Clatchians behind them. The council got to their feet in a hurry. Vimes recognized the Clatchian in the center of the group. He'd seen him around at official functions, and if it hadn't been for the fact that the man was a Clatchian, would have marked him down as a shifty piece of work.
Who's he?
He whispered to Carrot.
Prince Caliph. He's the deputy ambassador.
Another prince?
The man came to a halt in front of the table, glanced at Vimes with no show of recognition, and bowed to Lord Rust.
"Prince Caliph," said Lord Rust, "your arrival is unannounced, but nevertheless..."
"I have grave news, my lord."
Even in his stunned state, a part of Vimes registered that the voice was different. Kufura had learned his second language on the street, but this one had had tutors.
"At a time like this, what news isn't?" said Rust.
"There have been developments on the new land. Regrettable incidents, and indeed in Ankh-Morpork too."
He glanced at Vimes again.
"Although here, I must say, reports are confused. Lord Rust, I have to tell you, we are technically at war."
"Technically at war?" said Vimes.
"I'm afraid events are carrying us forward," said Caliph. "The situation is delicate."
"They know they're going to fight," Vimes thought. "This is just like the sort of a dance where you hang around looking at your partner."
"I must tell you that you are being given 12 hours to remove all your citizens from Leshp," said Caliph. "If that is done, matters will be happily resolved for the present."
"Our response is that you have 12 hours to quit Leshp," said Rust. "If that is not done, then we will take steps."
Caliph bowed slightly.
"We understand one another. A formal document will be with you shortly, and no doubt we will be receiving one from you."
"Indeed."
"Here, hang on, you can't just..."
Vimes began.
"Sir Samuel, you are no longer commander of the watch, and you have no place at these proceedings," said Rust sharply.
He turned back to the prince.
"It is unfortunate that things have come to this," he said stiffly.
"Indeed, but there comes a time when words are no longer sufficient."
"I must agree with you, and then it is time to test one's strength."
Vimes stared in fascinated horror from one face to the other.
"We will, of course, allow you time to quit your embassy, such of it as remains."
"So kind, and of course we will extend to you the same courtesy."
Caliph bowed slightly. So did Rust.
"After all, just because our countries are at war is no reason why we should not respect one another as friends,"
said Lord Rust.
"What? Yes, it bloody well is," said Vimes. "I can't believe this. You can't just stand there. Good grief, what happened to diplomacy?"
"War, Vimes, is a continuation of diplomacy by other means," said Lord Rust. "As you would know if you were really a gentleman."
"And you Clatchians are as bad," Vimes went on. "It's that green mouldy mutton Jenkins sells. You've all got foaming sheep disease. You can't just stand there and..."
"Sir Samuel, you are, as you are at pains to point out, a civilian," said Rust. "As such, you have no place here."
Vimes didn't bother with a salute, but just turned away and walked out of the room. The rest of the squad followed him in silence back to Pseudopolis Yard.
"I told him he could put it where the sun didn't shine," said Sergeant Colan as they crossed the brass bridge.
"That's right," said Vimes woodenly. "Well done."
"Right to his face? Where the sun don't shine, just like that," said Colan.
It was a little difficult to tell from his tone whether this was a matter of pride or dread.
"I'm afraid Lord Rust is technically correct, sir," said Carrot.
"Really?"
"Yes, Mr. Vimes, the safety of the city is of paramount importance, so in times of war the civil power is subject to military authority."
"Huh.
I told him," said Fred Colan. "Right where the sun does not shine, I said."
"The deputy ambassador didn't mention Prince Kufura," said Carrot. "That was odd."
"I'm going home," said Vimes.
"We're nearly there, sir," said Carrot. "I mean home. I need some sleep."
"Yes, sir. What shall I tell the lad, sir?"
"Tell him anything you like."
"I looked him right in the eye, and I told him. I said, 'You can put it right where the sun—'"
mused Sergeant Colon.
"You want me and some of the boys to go and sort out that rust later on?" said Detritus. "It's no problem. He's bound to be guilty of something."
"No."
Vimes's head felt so light now that he couldn't touch the ground with a rope. He left them outside the yard and let his head drag him on and up the hill and round the corner and into the house and past his astonished wife and up the stairs and into the bedroom, where he fell full length on the bed and was asleep before he hit it. At 9 the next morning, the first recruits from Lord Venturi's heavy infantry paraded down Broadway. The watchman went out to watch. That was all that was left for them to do. "Isn't that Mr. Vimes's butler?" said Angua, pointing to the stiff figure of Willikins in the front rank.
"Yeah, and that's his kitchen boy banging the drum in front," said Nobby.
"You were a military man, weren't you, Fred?" said Carrot, as the parade passed by.
"Yes, sir. Duke of Aorl's 1st Heavy Infantry, sir. The Pheasant Pluckers."
"Pardon?" said Angua.
"Nickname for the regiment, miss. All from ages ago. They were bivvywacking on some estate and came across a lot of pheasant pens and, well, you know, having to live off the land and everything. Anyway, that's why we always wore a pheasant feather on our helmets. Traditional, see?"
Already old Fred's face was creasing up in the soft expression of someone who's been mugged in memory lane.
"We even had a marching song," he said. "Mind you, it was quite hard to sing right. Sorry, miss?"
"Oh, it's all right, Sergeant," said Angua. "I often start to laugh like that for no reason at all." Fred Colon once again stared dreamily at nothing.
"And, of course, before that I was in the Duke of Quirm's middleweight infantry. Saw a lot of action with them."
"I'm sure you did," said Carrot, while Angua entertained cynical thoughts about the actual distance of Fred's vantage point. "Your distinguished military career has obviously given you many pleasant memories."
"The ladies liked the uniform," said Fred Colon,
with the unspoken rider that sometimes a growing lad needed all the help he could get.
"And it... well..."
"Yes, Sarge?" Colon looked awkward, as if the bunched underwear of the past was tangling itself in the crotch of recollection.
"It was more easier, sir, than being a copper, I mean. I mean, you're a soldier, right, and the other buggers is the enemy. You march into some big field somewhere and all form up into them oblongs, and then a bloke with a feathery helmet gives the order, and you all forms up into big arrows."
"Good gods, do people really do that? I thought it was just how they drew the battle plans."
"Well, the old Duke, sir, he did it by the book. Anyway, it's just a case of watching your back and walloping any bloke in the wrong uniform. But..."
Fred Colon's face screwed up in agonized thought.
"Well, when you're a copper, well, you don't know the good guys from the bad guys without a map, miss. And that's a fact."
"But there's military law, isn't there?"
"Well, yes, but when it's pissing with rain and you're up to your tonk, your waist, in dead horses, and someone gives you an order, that ain't the time to look up the book of rules, miss. Anyway, most of it's about when you're allowed to get shot, sir."
"Oh, I'm sure there's more to it than that, Sergeant."
"Oh, probably, sir," Colon conceded diplomatically.
"I'm sure there's lots of stuff about not killing enemy soldiers who've surrendered, for instance."
"Oh, yes, there's that, Captain. Doesn't say you can't duff 'em up a bit, of course. Just give 'em a little something to remember you by."
"Not torture," said Angua.
"Oh, no, miss. But,
Memory Lane for Colon had turned into a bad road through a dark valley.
"Well, when your best mate's got an arrow in his eye and there's blokes and horses screaming all around you and you're scared shit, well, you're really scared, and you come across one of the enemy, well, for some reason or other you've got this kind of urge to give him a bit of a nudge sort of thing. Just, you know, like, maybe in 20 years' time his leg'll twinge a bit on frosty days and he'll remember what he's done, that's all."
He rummaged in a pocket and produced a very small book, which he held up for inspection.
"This belonged to my great-granddad," he said. "He was in the scrap we had against Pseudopolis, and my great-grand gave him this book of prayers for soldiers, because you need all the prayers you can get, believe you me. And he stuck it in the top pocket of his jerkin, because he couldn't afford armour. And the next day in battle, whoosh, this arrow came out of nowhere, wham, straight into this book, and it went all the way through to the last page before stopping. Look, you can see the hole."
"Pretty miraculous," Carrot agreed.
"Yeah, it was, I suppose," said the sergeant.
He looked ruefully at the battered volume. "Shame about the other 17 arrows, really." The drumming died away. The remnant of the watch tried to avoid one another's gaze. Then an imperious voice said, "Why aren't you in uniform, young man?" Nobby turned. He was being addressed by an elderly lady with a certain turkey-like cast of feature and a capital punishment expression.
"Me? Got one, missus," said Nobby, pointing to his battered helmet.
"A proper uniform," snapped the woman, handing him a white feather. "What will you be doing when the Clatchians are ravishing us in our beds?"
She glared at the rest of the guards and swept on. Angua saw several others like her passing along the crowds of spectators. Here and there was a flash of white.
"I'll be thinking those Clatchians are jolly brave," said Carrot.
I'm afraid, Nobby, that the white feather is to shame you into joining up.
Oh, that's all right, then, said Nobby, a man for whom shame held no shame. What am I supposed to do with it? That reminds me, did I tell you what I said to Lord Rust?
Said Sergeant Colan nervously. 17 times so far, said Angua, watching the women with the feathers. She added, apparently to herself, come back with your shield or on it.
I wonder if I can get the lady to give me any more, said Nobby.
What was that? Said Carrot.
These feathers, said Nobby. They look like real goose. I've got a use for a lot more of these.
I meant, what was it that Angua said? Said Carrot. What? Oh, it's just something women used to say when they sent their men off to war. Come back with your shield or on it.
On your shield? Said Nobby. You mean like sledging sort of thing?
Like dead, said Angua. It meant come back a winner or not at all.
Well, I always came back with my shield, said Nobby. No problem there. Nobby, sighed Colan. You used to come back with your shield, everyone else's shield, a sack of teeth and 15 pairs of still warm boots on a cart.
Well, no point in going to war unless you're on the winning side, said Nobby, sticking the white feather in his helmet.
Nobby, you was always on the winning side, the reason being you used to lurk around the edges to see who was winning, and then pull the right uniform off of some poor dead sod. I used to hear where the generals kept an eye on what you were wearing so they'd know how the battle was going. Lots of soldiers have served in lots of regiments, said Nobby. Right, what you say is true, only not usually during the same battle, said Sergeant Colan.
They trooped back into the watch house. Most of the shift had taken the day off. After all, who was in charge? What were they supposed to be doing today? The only ones left were those who never thought of themselves as off-duty, and the new recruits who hadn't had their keen edge blunted. I'm sure Mr. Vimes will think of something, said Carrot. Look, I'd better take the Goriffs back to their shop. Mr. Goriff says he's going to pack up and leave. A lot of Clatchians are leaving. You can't blame them either. Dreams rising with him like bubbles, Vimes surfaced from the black fathoms of sleep. Normally these days he treasured the moment of waking. It was when solutions presented themselves. He assumed bits of his brain came out at night and worked on the problems of the previous day, handing him the result just as he opened his eyes. All that arrived now were memories. He winced. Another memory turned up. He groaned. The sound of his badge bouncing on the table replayed itself. He swore. He swung his legs off the covers and groped for the bedside table.
Bingly bingly beep.
Oh, no. All right, what's the time?
1 o'clock p.m. Hello, insert name here.
Vimes looked blearily at the disorganizer. One day he knew he really would have to try to understand the manual for the damn thing. Either that or drop it off a cliff. One of the universal rules of happiness is always be wary of any helpful item that weighs less than its operating manual. What? He began, and then groaned again. The twanging sound made by the unwound turban as it took his weight had just come back to haunt him.
Sam?
The bedroom door was pushed open and Sybil came in carrying a cup.
Yes, dear.
How do you feel?
I've got bruises on my bruises.
Another memory crawled up from the pit of guilt.
Oh, good grief, did I really call him a long streak of...
Yes, said his wife. Fred Colan came round this morning and told me all about it. And a very good description, I'd say. I went out with Ronnie Rust once. Bit of a cold fish.
Another recollection burst like a ball of marsh gas in Vimes's head.
Did Fred tell you where he said Rust could put his badge?
Yes. 3 times. It seems to be weighing on his mind. Anyway, knowing Ronnie, he'd have to use a hammer.
Vimes had long ago got used to the fact that the aristocracy all seemed to know one another by their first name.
And did Fred tell you anything else? He said timidly.
Yes, about the shop and the fire and everything. I'm proud of you.
She gave him a kiss.
What do I do now? He said.
Drink your tea and have a wash and a shave.
I ought to go down to the watch house and...
A shave! There's hot water in the jug.
When she'd left, he hauled himself upright and tottered into his bedroom. There was indeed a jug of hot water on the marble washstand. He looked at his face in the mirror. Unfortunately, it was his. Perhaps if he shaved it first and then he could wash the bits that were left. Fragments of the night before kept on respectfully drawing themselves to his attention. It was a shame about that guard, but sometimes you just couldn't stand and argue. He shouldn't have done that with his badge. It wasn't like the old days.
He had responsibilities. He should have stayed on and made things just a little less... No, that never worked. He managed to get the lather on his face. The Riot Act. Good grief. He stropped his razor thoughtfully. Rust's milky eyes stared out of his memory. Bastard. Men like that thought, they really thought, that the watch was a kind of sheepdog to nip at the heels of the flock, bark when spoken to, and never, ever bite the shepherd. Ah, yes, Vimes knew in his bones who the enemy was. Except no badge, no watch, no job. Another memory arrived, late. Lather still dripping down his shirt, he pulled Vetinari's sealed letter out of his pocket and slit it open with the razor. There was a blank sheet of paper inside. He turned it over and there was nothing on the other side either. Mystified, he glanced at the envelope. Sir Samuel Vimes, Knight. Nice of him to be so precise about it, Vimes thought. What was the point of a message with no message? Some people might absent-mindedly have slipped the wrong piece of paper in an envelope, but Vetinari wouldn't. What was the point of sending him a note telling him he was a knight, for God's sake? He knew that embarrassing fact well enough. Another little memory burst open as silently as a mouse passing wind in a hurricane. Who'd said it? Any gentleman? Vimes stared. Well, he was a gentleman, wasn't he? It was official. And then he didn't shout, and he didn't run out of the room. He finished shaving, had a wash, and put on a change of underwear very calmly. Downstairs, Sybil had cooked him a meal. She wasn't a very good cook. This was fine by Vimes because he wasn't a very good eater. After a lifetime of street meals, his stomach wasn't set up right. What it craved was little crunchy brown bits, the food group of the gods, and Sybil reliably always left the pan too long on the dragon. She eyed him carefully as he chewed his fried egg and stared into the middle distance. Her manner was that of someone with a portable safety net, watching a man on the high wire. After a while she watched him crack open a sausage, he said, "Do we have any books on chivalry, dear?" "Hundreds, Sam. Is there anyone which tells you what, you know, what it's all about? I mean, what you have to do if you're a knight, say. Responsibilities and so on?" "Most of them, I should think." "Good. I think I shall do a little reading." Vimes hit the bacon with his fork. It shattered, very satisfactorily. Afterwards, he went into the library. 20 minutes later, he came back out for a pencil and some paper. 10 minutes after that, Lady Sybil took him a cup of coffee. He was hidden behind a pile of books, and apparently deep in Life of Chivalry. She crept out and went into her own study, where she settled down to update her dragon breeding records. It was an hour later when she heard him step out into the hall. He was humming under his breath, tunelessly, with the faraway look of preoccupation that means that some big thought has required the shutting down of all non-essential processes. He was also re-radiating the field of angered innocence that was to her part of his essential Vimesness.
"Are you going out, Sam?"
"Yes."
"I'm just going to kick some arse, dear."
"Oh, good. Just be sure you wrap up well, then."